From the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, this is a Guy's Take episode. What is up, Cryptoconomy crew? I am your host, Guy Swan, and you are listening to the Cryptoconomy Podcast, where we read and cover all the coolest shit in the Bitcoin economy and the cryptoconomy at large. So, the theme for this week has been how to define Bitcoin and the nature of fully validating nodes. And honestly, some of the best stuff I've read on this has been stuff that I read in the past, stuff that's already been done on the show, like Stop and Decrypt's piece on, he starts it off with the impenetrable fortress of validation. I cannot remember, how did I not look this up? I cannot remember the name of the episode off the top of my head. Let's see if I can find it real quick. Stop and Decrypt? Nope, that's not in here. Let's do maybe nodes. 1, 2, 3. Casa node, features of the Casa node. Nope, okay. Validation. Nope. Fortress. Nope. All right, you know what? I'm just going to pause and then I'll find it. Look how quick I managed that. It's called Bitcoin Miners Beware. Invalid blocks need not apply. But that's not actually the one. I just found it in Stop and Decrypt's thing. I'm not sure if he, like, broke it up, but it does not appear to... I don't have that one, actually. Invalid. Yeah, see, I don't even have that episode. I know I read it aloud, but it appears to have been broken up from other episodes. He broke the articles down into smaller pieces. So I'll have to figure out, piece together exactly which one it was that I did read back when it was apparently in one larger article as opposed to multiple smaller articles. But the idea was that Bitcoin was an impenetrable fortress of validation. And it's a really, really great article talking about the structure of the Bitcoin network and what full nodes do on the network and the distinguishing between miners and regular full nodes and that kind of thing, which we are going to get into in this, but not quite in as much detail as Stop and Decrypt does in their article. So today, for our purposes, we are going to... I tried to turn this into an article like 20 times, but for some reason I never like the way it sounds as an article. It's much better as like kind of a stream of thought. I'm just way better with audio than I am with sitting down and writing it all. So we're just going to make this into a Guy's Take episode rather than a quick read of one of my articles. I do have this whole thing written up, but I just don't want to go through and edit it all. So I'm going to go ahead and just start hitting the bullet points. But what we have here, what we're talking about is the difference between a network of fully validating nodes and a network where everybody is an SPV node, where miners are the only validators on the network, and what the dynamics of that situation is or are. Because every fully validating nodes, what is a node? Like, what does it mean to have a node? Like, you'll hear so many people, some people tell you nodes are the most important thing on the network. Some people will just be like, nodes are meaningless. If you're running a node, you don't mean shit on the network. Like, literally, people will get mad at you and act like you're an idiot for running a node. Those are typically the big blockers, because that's just kind of how they think about it. But what does it mean to have a fully validating node? A fully validating node, one that's fully archival, that stores everything from the beginning of the blockchain all the way to the end and confirms and validates all the hashes and signatures and everything, is one that rejects anything outside of the consensus rules. Only data which falls entirely within the constraints of what you're allowed to do in Bitcoin is acceptable for a fully validating node. everything else will be kicked out and ignored as meaningless. The very reason that Bitcoin has any rules at all is due to the process of the fully validating node. Otherwise, there are no rules. And whether that node is mining or that it's just simply a node on your own computer that's just sharing the blockchain, both of these things are irrelevant. Mining is not a process of validation. Like we discussed yesterday, or in the last episode, Quick Read 246, I think it was. This will be a guy's take, so it probably won't be obvious the order of this. But just like I discussed in that episode when we were going over the errors and terminology issues in the white paper that turned out to be different in Bitcoin's implementation, you can easily mine without validating anything. They are completely separate processes. And that's despite the fact that sometimes, obviously, the same device or client is doing both of those actions. Early on in the Bitcoin network, after Bitcoin actually achieved a real-world price, thanks to Laszlo, what's-his-face? You can get that little tidbit on the Bitcoin holiday calendar on the website, cryptoeconomy.life. The shift away from CPU mining happened really quickly. And this was after Bitcoin had a real-world price because suddenly there was a real cost and profit margin to mining Bitcoin, whereas before it was just kind of, if you had a CPU, you just mined. But Bitcoin wasn't, it didn't have a price, so it didn't really matter whether you were quote-unquote profitable in that task or not. So there was a short period where you could realistically mine with your GPU instead of your CPU, your graphics unit. And then quickly it jumped over to FPGAs. Everybody was realizing that they could one up the game by using FPGAs are field programmable gate arrays. They're basically like customizable hardware that you install a software on so that they're really, really good at running a specific thing. So it's very much, whereas GPU is just slightly better. It's just a faster processor than your CPU at mining. It's more optimal. FPGAs are another level of optimization. And then ASICs, and that transition happened really quick. That was all pretty much the same year. It was completely dominated by GPUs. Then it started shifting. People were just unloading FPGAs like crazy. And then finally, ASICs started coming out. And ASICs are application-specific integrated circuits. And what that means is that they have literally designed the chip to only do the SHA-256 hash. Like the actual hardware, rather than being essentially a universal chip that you just give it instructions to do certain specific tasks. And it can mold itself, essentially, programmatically to do any of those tasks. This is actually embedded in the hardware. So the chip has the entire path of the SHA-256 hash embedded inside of it. So it's the peak of efficiency when it comes to mining. There's nothing that can compare to it. But honestly, right when the job switched from CPUs to GPUs, before we got to FPGAs and ASICs, running a node and mining immediately began to divorce from each other, because the process of like proof of work is just one part of a long list of consensus rules. Miners were still running full nodes at the time, for the most part, and I imagine that's true now if you're not counting the tens of thousands of miners who are just joining a pool. Undoubtedly, the vast majority of them are not running a node, as the pool operator is the one that's running the node and confirming the data that all of the people who have joined the pool should be hashing. So they're trusting someone else to run the node on their behalf, and they're just providing their hashes to the pool, all of them in hopes of, you know, going in on the lottery together. But still, users continue to run full nodes while turning off the mining functionality in the client, because it stressed out their computer, it cost a lot in electricity, and it quickly became a pointless endeavor. If you didn't have a GPU or then an FPGA, you weren't mining anything anyway. You were, you know, mining alone was just laughably ridiculous in a matter of months. So another important consideration in Stop and Decrypt's article is that miners, which I still encourage you to, there's a couple of them right there. They're all together about kind of the same topic, like Lightning Network centralization and that kind of thing. But they go into the fact that miners are indistinguishable from any other peer on the network. Like, your node doesn't see miners separately from other nodes. If a miner sends you a block, or you get that same block from my Raspberry Pi node, your node has no idea which one it was, and it doesn't care. There's no like label or something put on it. It doesn't go like, oh shit, this block is from a miner. I should pay extra close attention to this and value this block more highly than the one from the Raspberry Pi over here. No validating node cares whatsoever. The rules that they validate against have nothing to do with where it got the block. They could receive it over a radio broadband signal or from a satellite, or it could be scanned into a computer with a QR code or something. I mean, it doesn't matter where it gets the information. It just validates the information itself. So there's no discerning. From the perspective of validation, a node is a node is a node. A transaction is always just a transaction, and a block is always a block. And it's core to Satoshi's design. It's and easily demonstrated. Like, there's no special cases here. That's why. So anybody who thinks that like a miner or a supposed leader has any pull in the space, it's entirely within the social sphere. It has nothing to do with the rules or the operation of the actual network. So the nodes are what make up that network. Without nodes, users cannot receive data. They can't. Nodes are the reference for everything on the network. They validate and then send the data forward to other nodes, and then light clients and services and everything else. Light clients have to connect to the network of nodes. So like when I boot up a light client, just a general light client, one that doesn't connect specifically to like let's say I've got like a wallet with Casa, I'm connecting straight to Casa and they're providing me with data from their full node. Or as supposedly is going to be a feature to come in the near future, is I'm going to be able to connect my wallet to my full node at my house, so that I'm just referencing my own full node. But regardless, if I just have a general light client, a general light wallet, I am just reaching out to the thousands and thousands of nodes out there on the network and requesting data as I need it. And I don't really care what one node is from the other. So because of that, the network has serious limitations depending on how many nodes it has. Like, only a node can only handle, like a typical connection can only handle so many peers connecting to it. Like, you know, if there was only one node on the network, the millions and millions of individuals requiring data from the Bitcoin network could not just pull it all from one node. And like if it was my Raspberry Pi node, I'd have 16 connections, and then my device would be completely overloaded. I wouldn't be able to do anything else. Like, so unless that's maintained on a Google data center, you can't even get the data to the millions of users without a huge subset of nodes on the network. So when people, when you hear somebody give some explanation that nodes don't do anything, or some people have even argued that nodes are harmful for the network, that's ridiculous. That's like saying peers on a BitTorrent network make it harder to get the information. That's bullshit. Like, the number of nodes is directly related to, or indirectly related to, the number of people that can connect and access the information. And it's obviously directly related to the amount of validation that's going on within the network, and thus the risk associated with trusting that network. So trying to do this with a small number of nodes would bring the network data stream to a halt unless you had giant centralized institutions that everybody connected to. Obviously, the situation of trust would be terrible as well, because everybody is simply trusting that one node to give them correct information. Which isn't anything special. So in the article I was talking about earlier, what did Stop and Decrypt mean when they call it a impenetrable fortress of validation? And they have a really, really good visualization of the whole network of nodes and like their interconnectedness, which is wonderful. I definitely recommend just go look at it just so you can see, because it's a really, really great way to see what's happening on the network and how data is served on the network. But the key factor in this is that any invalid block, whether it has a double spend or they attempt to spend coins that they don't have the signature to, that like someone else owns, that any transaction in that block that has maybe an incorrect balance, a block without the correct proof of work in the header, without the correct ordering in the hash, even one with a timestamp outside of a certain threshold, is immediately rejected. Absolutely anything at all that does not 100% follow every consensus rule in Bitcoin is rejected and deleted by every single full node on the network. It does not enter the network. It stops at the first full node and vanishes. So, and sometimes depending on the severity of the violation, of like what was being cheated, like if they're spending coins with a false signature, or it's a block that attempts to create more Bitcoin than is allowed in the Coinbase, it actually results in a temporary or permanent ban of whoever sent them that information. So even if it's just like a full node with malware on it that is completely, you know, doesn't even know that it's feeding crappy information to other nodes on the network, they just lose their connection to the network. They get put on a automatic blacklist, essentially. So what does this mean for users? Every service, exchange, wallet, Block Explorer, a Lightning wallet, a store, all of it, all of those are backed by full nodes, pretty much. That's pretty much the norm. And sometimes they're not propagating information. They're just doing it passively by ensuring they're connected to the right network. But many of them are live nodes that are sending data forward, propagating blocks, receiving transactions into their mempool and then sharing it with their peers, et cetera, et cetera. And any exchange worth its salt, anything that's not just a shady piece of crap, is absolutely running a fully validating node. Every Block Explorer is a fully validating node. That's why it's an explorer. That's why you can look up all the information. And obviously wallet services that, you know, you have like Casa, great example. I've got my Casa Lite wallet. And I'm connecting to their service because they have a full node that is sending me the data that I'm requesting. So this is so users can connect to it and they have the data on hand to ensure I can get all of it. The nodes are a massive wall between the market and any inaccurate data. The only thing that miners actually produce that fully validating nodes aren't doing is the hash at the top of a block. That's it. And the hash, the proof of work, is only one of a large set of consensus rules. Just because they are producing one piece of the consensus rules, just like a user who has the keys is providing a single their accurate signature, that doesn't mean that they control all the signatures on the chain. And just because a miner has produced one hash on a block does not mean that they control all of the other consensus rules. But we'll get to why in just a minute. Breaking any one of those consensus rules makes the data equally invalid. It doesn't care if it's like a little break. Like there is no such thing as maybe breaking the rules or breaking the rules really badly. It's a zero or a one game. It's a yes or a no. There's no gray areas. There's no let's go halvesies. It either follows all of the rules or the information gets deleted, period. So kind of an analogous situation. It really falls short of the degree of enforcement that nodes are actually providing, but it's still a good analogy for imagining what's going on. Is if you take gold bullion or gold coins into a jeweler or pawn shop to be sold. If you have ever done that, you know that they'll take the metal. Like, you have to sit there for a minute. They'll take the metal, they're going to scratch it, they'll weigh it. They do a whole process of tests to be relatively sure, you know, like 98% sure that they're getting one solid piece of gold. They can't really know for 100% without like melting it down and inspecting all of it, but they can at least be certain enough for the amount of risk they're taking on, so that like they're probably not going to do just the scratch and weigh test if they've bought $10 million worth of gold bars, the process is probably going to be a little bit more in depth. But if they're buying four coins from you, it's probably no big deal. So this process, the process of validating the gold, is very akin to the process of what a validating node does. Like, you can't sell them copper and pretend it's gold. You can't, like, write gold with a magic marker on top of the copper and give it to them, and they're going to be like, what are you doing? Now, if they did not do any of the process, you could. Of course, you know, they're taking you at your word for whether or not it's gold. If they don't, I mean, think about it. Part of the process of validation is in looking at it and seeing if it's the gold color. An SPV node doesn't even do that. If you don't have a fully validating node, you might as well be holding copper with gold written on it in a magic marker. But the difference is the validating nodes secure way more information about the nature of Bitcoin than a simple testing of whether gold is real. Obviously, testing for the purity of gold doesn't prevent somebody from, you know, somewhere else in the world finding 100 tons of gold in a mine that was previously unknown. The gold supply is relatively predictable, but it has no specific inflation schedule outside of the fact that it's naturally difficult to acquire in the wild. That's what made it a great money. It's an unforgeable costliness, as Szabo says. So a node validates way more data than that. It validates the entire total worldwide supply of Bitcoin in circulation. It is the most strictly defined and unchanging inflation schedule in the world. Every single Satoshi, the smallest unit of Bitcoin possible, is perfectly accounted for. And there's a strict limit on how much data that network can be flooded with at any time to prevent overloading the nodes in the process of validation. I mean, imagine if you could give the jeweler, you could have people come to that jeweler at thousands of people per second just running into the store and saying, buy my gold, buy my gold, buy my gold. He's not going to be able to keep up with validating all of that gold. That's the equivalent of having no block size, is you can just overload the nodes and the network and everybody on the ability to validate at any reasonable speed. And then you've immediately turned it into a trust situation where the guy's just going to be like, I either accept all of these gold coins without validating and continue to do business, or I just stop accepting gold altogether because I have no idea whether or not it's copper or it's tungsten painted, blah, 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 etc. So that's the point of the block size limit, is to make sure with a very strict limit that you cannot overload the nodes in the network, that the network has time to stay in consensus and check every gold bar that is moving within the network. And of course, it also validates the entire history of the chain of ownership of every coin all the way back to the original creation. Gold validation cannot boast this. This is something that only Bitcoin does. And it does this validation for all users, services, wallets, exchanges, everywhere. So if someone tries to spend a Bitcoin that does not follow the rules, regardless of exactly why, could be signature, amount, inflation, blah, 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 it cannot even be seen within the network. An exchange cannot scan it in their mempool and find it. You can't look it up on a block explorer. You can't find it in your wallet. It is as meaningless as me like opening up my notepad on my computer and typing 100 Bitcoin into the notepad and then pretending that I now have that money. I can do nothing with it because nobody can see it on the network. So back to the gold analogy. This is like, imagine the difference between gold validation and Bitcoin validation is as if I took a gold-plated piece of tungsten, like a tungsten bar, and tried to pass it off as gold into the jeweler, and they do a scratch and weigh test, realize that it's fake, and then give it back to me and, you know, tell me to buzz off. Now imagine if I took that same coin to a random guy on the street and took it out of my pocket to show him, but the coin was now, or the bar of gold was now invisible. I'm holding it out in my hand and he sees just my empty hand, and I'm trying to convince him that there really is a coin there, that there's really is gold there, and he's just looking at me like a total moron. That's the equivalent of trying to sell somebody Bcash and calling it Bitcoin. Is the rules have completely changed. So if that person is running a full node or they are asking other full nodes on the network, they see nothing. They have to just believe me that my empty, seemingly empty hand has a bar of gold in it. That's the equivalent of what the full nodes do for the market or for the network. They not only reject bad coins, but they prevent it from being seen by anyone else attached to that network. So the network is the market. That is so important to understand. The network of nodes is the market. It is how the markets get data. The market gets the data. It is how the market distinguishes Bitcoin from any other coin. They're just digital tokens. They're just digital points. They are indistinguishable, except for the fact that they can be proven to have followed a certain set of rules. So we will get to even big blockers like completely agree that the market is what makes Bitcoin valuable. They will just disagree about the fact that nodes are useful in the market at all. They think the market is just miners and nothing else. But Bitcoin, because of that market, is really valuable. It is not an insignificant liquid asset at all. The infrastructure and services around it have exploded massively in the last 2 or 3 years. And I came from having to use it and interact with it 2 to 3 years ago, and I know the difference. It's huge. There are multiple large liquid markets for buying and selling. There are products and services that I can purchase with it that just weren't even close to possible 2 or 3 years ago. You can now have custom contracts. There are lending markets that are secured by it, financial instruments backed by it, on and on and on. It's massive now. That market is the reason it has value, is because of the infrastructure and the services and the market as a whole. Those tools and participants are what give it value. Without any of that, miners can't use their Bitcoin for anything. They can't pay for the massive amount of hardware they've invested in, the electricity and maintenance costs. I mean, without the market of services and exchanges, the miner has no reason to mine anything. Why would they produce hashes if they might as well just endlessly hash a picture of a cat on their computer? It would probably cost them less. So even big blockers will admit that the market is what determines the value of coins, just before telling you that nodes don't do anything if there aren't mining. So we will get to how to prove that this is nonsense in just a second, but it has gotten really hot in here because I'm all riled up, and I'm going to take a break and sit in the coolness for just a second. We'll hit our sponsor and come right back to how we know the nodes determine the value of the miners' coins. Okay, so how do we prove that miners, what's our thought experiment for showing why it is that miners do not have leverage over the rules? So the simplest way to think about this, comparing, if we're talking about an attempt by, I mean, the only reasonable assumption here is that we're assuming miners have colluded to change the rules of the network, to alter the consensus rules, and how does the market enforce whether or not they can do this? And the only sensible way, like obviously there's tons of gray areas here that we could like screw around with, and we could talk about whether or not it would work in this market. It doesn't really matter. The only way to fully demonstrate the difference between fully validating nodes and then something like a light client or an SPV node that does not validate any of the rules but only checks to see if their transactions are in a block, that's pretty much what all of the light clients do, is to compare two different networks, one where everyone is running a fully validating node, like literally everyone, and anybody who participates whatsoever, any new user boots up a full node, and then another network where every single person is running a light client. There is not a single person who is not one of the big miners who is running a full node, either because it's too costly or they just simply choose to. It doesn't matter. Everybody is connecting directly to mining nodes. So those are our two networks, and they're diametrically opposed. We have one everybody is fully validating, And then the other, nobody is validating. All the stuff in between is just a gray area that just kind of confuses the point and makes it more difficult to demonstrate what's actually going on. But anything in the middle is just a spectrum leaning towards one or the other. We're either leaning heavily towards a wide distribution of fully validating nodes, or we're leaning heavily towards everybody's using light clients and custodial and trusting miners, et cetera, et cetera. So we basically do all or nothing here. And now let's assume 90% of the miners, because I think it's unrealistic for 100% of the miners to do anything. We've never had 100% of the miners pretty much agree to anything. So we'll take a heavy share in favor of the miners that they are on board with canceling the next halving. Now, I know we've had a ton of new listeners in the last month or so. So anybody who is still early in on this, the halvening is what it's referred to as, is when the inflation rate of new Bitcoin is cut in half. So you may have heard, just as a general description of Bitcoin, that it gets harder and harder to make Bitcoin as time goes on. Well, there's two different parts of the consensus rules that make it harder and harder to make Bitcoin. The first is the difficulty adjustment or the difficulty of making new blocks. This is adjusted based on the amount of hash power that is either joining or leaving the network. So, and this is done so that the probability of a new block being produced is still an estimated 10-minute interval. Like, blocks come in, the heartbeat of Bitcoin and extending the chain and new transactions is every 10 minutes. Boom, 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 we've got new blocks. And if suddenly that speeds up too fast, if we have double the number of computers in like a matter of days come online and they're producing hashes way, way faster, well, then the block time is going to fall to like 5 minutes per block. It's going to boom, 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 boom. So the network is basically getting overheated. So the difficulty adjusts to cool everything down to make sure that when all these new computers come on the network, we still get that 10-minute interval. It's every 2,016 blocks. It's about 2 weeks on average. And then the same thing happens in the reverse. If a bunch of computers leave the network and suddenly our heartbeat is getting really slow, well, then it lowers the difficulty adjustment after 2,016 blocks, adjusting it back up to 10 minutes per block. And now the second consensus rule is about the inflation schedule that makes it harder to produce Bitcoin. And that's what we're talking about with the halvening. Every block allows a miner to create new coins for themselves, coins that did not exist before. And with the first block in existence, for thousands of blocks after that, there were 50 coins per block could be invented out of thin air, or as long as you produce the accurate hash, actually. And that period is a set of 210,000 blocks, and that equates to about every 4 years. And after those 210,000 blocks, that number gets cut in half, hence the name, the halvening. So 50 coins in, 2013 turned into 25 coins. And then in 2017? I guess it was early 17. Yeah, 2000, around mid-2017, it cut into 12.5, which is what it currently is at the time of this recording. And then in like 390 days-ish or something like that, it's going to drop to 6.25. It's going to keep getting cut in half, and this will actually happen indefinitely. It will just continuously approach zero without ever actually getting there. You'll hear people say that the inflation actually stops at the year 2140, and that there will only ever be 21 million coins. But the truth is that it's actually just the number gets so small at that point. It's like 1.1135, something like that, satoshis that are mined. But the satoshi is the smallest unit. It's 1/10 millionth of a Bitcoin currently. The smallest unit is 1/10 millionth of a Bitcoin. So you can't actually get that 0.1 denomination out. You can only produce one Satoshi. And then when that gets cut in half, if you can't, you know, stipulate that it's a full Satoshi, well, then cutting in half again becomes impossible. But if Bitcoin is actually still around by then, you know, all the hashes are secure and we've updated it and it's managed to survive that long, we can easily soft fork in a whole bunch of new decimal places if it comes to the point where that's actually really important. But so the current rate is 12.5, and it's going to drop to 6.25. But this is terrible for miners, right? Like, these guys work on very small margins, and they do not want to see their pay get cut in half. Nobody does. You don't want your pay to get cut in half. Why would they want their pay to get cut in half? So in their self-interest, obviously, it would make sense that they would want to prevent this from happening without, hopefully, threatening the whole value of Bitcoin in general. But so first, let's assume 90% of them are on board, and so what would happen if the entire network just followed the miners and were using light clients or SPV nodes? So our first scenario is everybody's using light clients, nobody's running a validating node, and everybody's just trusting the miners. What they do is they will check to make sure their own addresses or transactions are valid, like they have signatures and stuff, and that they're included in a block. But they will not check any of the rules. They will not check the rest of the block, any of the other transactions, the inflation rate, the block size, any other signatures, the proof of work, nothing. Just as long as it's in a block and the header is hashed from the previous, they don't care about the difficulty. At least I don't think they check the difficulty. Regardless, it doesn't matter. They don't check any of the other meaningful stuff. They're only interested in their own addresses. So technically, I guess, if they don't check the actual difficulty, miners could even just change the block time and any amount of computation needed to make a block if they just thought it was too difficult. But regardless, so all SPV clients. So the miners are either attempting this inflation coup. They can do this either secretly or with some big social campaign. The social campaign, obviously, I would think, has a much higher chance of success, as they can probably make ignorant people afraid that, you know, Bitcoin will die without the block subsidy and that this is in everybody's best interest, and rather than the truth, that it's in their best interest at everyone else's expense. And, you know, so they try to get them to not be completely outraged by this complete fundamental change of the monetary policy of Bitcoin. So let's assume with this scenario that maybe 70%, 80% that don't even know that this debate or social campaign is going on. Maybe they're like, it's kind of like with voters in like an election. You only get like 40%, sometimes even 30% of voter turnout. The vast majority of people just don't participate. And obviously this is true of like Twitter and like a Facebook debate or something. Like, not everybody is on Twitter. Like, Twitter is not the world. There are millions of people who use Bitcoin that don't go up on crypto Twitter and know who's crypto famous and all of that stuff. Like, they're just using it out in the wild. So they may not even know that this debate is going on. Maybe it's even in a language that they don't, like, maybe it's almost all like secluded to Chinese miners and the whole debate is in Chinese. And we don't even know about it. Like, you know, all the people who speak Russian, German, or French, they don't even know what's going on. But maybe not, maybe not. Maybe they managed to stretch this campaign far and wide across crypto Twitter. But we'll assume that probably a safe 70 or 80% really just don't even know what's happening. But again, we're assuming they are also running fully, like, I mean, nothing but light clients. So the miners make this big stink. They're going to end the halvening. They're going to vow to do this with a two-week countdown. Very possibly, there's a huge ton of people making a fuss about this. There's going to be heated debates. There's going to be defending and attacking this proposal. And it's going to be hugely controversial, maybe even the price swings during this time. But everybody's running light clients. So when the miners switch over to the new block reward, what happens? They've instead of switching from 6.2, switching down to 6.25, they just keep 12.5. What happens? Not a single client on the network notices a difference. They're not checking. Everything seems to continue as if nothing changed. Every block explorer accepts the transactions with the fake Bitcoin. All the new blocks come in without question every service. I mean, technically, a block explorer is not an explorer anymore if it's not a full node, but, you know, whatever. Every service is immediately sending coins over this new inflation schedule, this completely different set of rules. All the people who are trading Bitcoin, the markets for liquidity, the services, the people accepting Bitcoin, the infrastructure, financial contracts, everything is now backed by a Bitcoin with a fundamentally different set of rules. It looks nothing like it did previously. It has none of the assurances it did before. It's literally as if, ever back to our analogy, it's as if every piece of gold in the world suddenly turned into copper. It's far less scarce, it now corrodes over time, and is far less valuable than gold because it no longer has gold's attributes, no longer has those characteristics. But no one can tell the difference. They look exactly the same. Or it just actually wouldn't be that they look exactly the same. It would be that no one is looking at it. They're all just closing their eyes when they exchange the coins, and they just assume they're holding gold, but now they're all holding copper. So the ones that fought against this campaign only even know because they were told that this new block reward was happening. But again, they're running SPV, so they might even have been tricked. Maybe it didn't happen. There's no confirmation one way or the other. And then the 70 to 80% who were not even aware of this debate or the social campaign are already following it without having the slightest clue. They're providing their liquidity to it. They're supporting its infrastructure. Their jobs are providing its platforms. They're buying the new coins, which, like, not knowing whether the coins are under new rules or old rules. It's just digital points, you know, like, a digital point on computer A is no different than a digital point on computer B. It's not like one integer is like way more valuable than another integer on a different computer or in a different piece of software. Like it's just digits. It is the rules that allow you to change those digits that define a Bitcoin. It is nothing about what they look like or what you can do with them. Because a digital bit is a digital bit, period. If there is a certain specific database that has a specific set of rules that cannot be changed, that is how you define a Bitcoin. Otherwise, it's just digital bits. Without validating the rules, it is completely meaningless. So this is actually really similar to a situation we currently have with the dollar. Technically, what we're seeing is a group of authorities will get together and they change the rules as they see fit for the rest of the market. A small portion will care about this, you know, like people who are actually active and know about monetary policy and economics. Like, they'll be pissed. They'll be following their decisions and trying to keep track of everything that's going on. But the vast majority of people just go about their daily lives because they're too busy. And, you know, they're just gonna sit around and bitch about the never-ending rising costs of healthcare, housing, education, and they just won't have a clue that all of these problems are unconditionally tied to the decisions of that monetary policy, of that monetary structure. Inevitably, a market that either does not or is not able to distinguish at the individual level between copper and gold, the jeweler or the pawn shop in this example, not confirming what metal they're buying, will eventually be trading the one that's cheaper to produce. I would suggest listening to Nick Szabo's shelling out for a really lengthy explanation of unforgeable costliness and why the cost of producing money or the price of money will always tend towards the cost of producing it, regardless of how much time it takes to get there or what false barriers you put in its way. And this is why fiat paper money eventually becomes as worthless as the paper it's printed on, because there is no actual costliness to its creation. The self-interest of the producers will catch up if the market has no fundamental defense against them doing so. They will profit massively off the ability to create their money or to dictate the cost of their creating the money. In the case of gold, we have physics defending it. In the case of Bitcoin, we have validation. So with money in your bank account, if your bank altered the rules, you might not even know, right? If they adjust their reserve requirements or their lending risks, Like you're not gonna read that 20-page report they sent to you in the mail. You're gonna be like, oh God, another one of these, and you're gonna rip it up and you're gonna throw it away. And they have your money too, because the rules that control that money are determined by them and them alone. The whole not your keys, not your coins, that only applies because the rules that make Bitcoin spendable cannot be changed. A spendable or preventing someone from spending it without the proper keys is should be unalterable. If the miners can easily change the inflation schedule, then the fact that you have the keys to your coins doesn't mean jack. Because if they can change the inflation schedule, they can just change these consensus rules, which means that your keys and your coins are linked if miners allow them to be linked. That's it. Like, it's again, this is digital. You could just edit digital stuff really easily. If there are no rules being validated here, restraining what someone can do in the network, then it's meaningless. It's just a notepad that we're all sharing. So now let's look at the exact same scenario, but everyone on the network, every wallet, computer, service exchange, derivative contract, a block explorer, everything is backed by a fully validating node. What happens when the miners ignore the halvening this time? Nothing. Nothing at all. Miners cannot do anything with their newly self-aggrandizing coin balances that they get to feel rich all by their lonesome. They've now begun burning millions of dollars worth of electricity for points on their computer screen that they can send nowhere. They can't send them to an exchange because the block will be rejected. The transaction will not be visible. They cannot use them to buy anything from services or any products because the transaction will be rejected. They cannot find their transaction in a block explorer, in a wallet, nowhere. Only if they specifically change, if somebody, I would have to go in and change my software explicitly to be okay with 12.5 Bitcoin created every block, to delete the halvening out of my own consensus rules in order to even do business with them, which means the 70 to 80% of people who don't know what's going on never would follow the miners. By default, they're rejecting everything and they have no idea why. It's literally as if the miners' coins don't exist. Within the network of validating nodes, they just aren't there. It's the invisible piece of metal. So the only place that they can actually send those coins to or share those coins with is the tiny group of miners, or, well, 90% of the miners, so maybe it's like 100 miners, 200 miners. Only in that small little group who join their network can they actually send those digital points back and forth with. But guess what all of those people are doing? Burning through cash like crazy. There is no productive entity in that whole group. They're all just consuming massive amounts of electricity, and they've got nowhere to sell their coins to except for other people burning through massive amounts of electricity. What are they going to do? So what happens to the Bitcoin network? What happens to the network with the 10% of the miners left over? So the only change to that network is that block times increase from 10-minute intervals to an hour and a half. Which after 2016 of those, it will drop significantly, moving almost all the way back to 10-minute interval, which is inconvenient, to be sure. Without a doubt, it's a pain in the ass to be like, oh my God, I have to wait an hour and a half for a confirmation. And it's basically, it's kind of akin to going to a jeweler and they confirm, it's like, okay, yes, this is gold, but then they tell you that they're not accepting any more today, that you'll have to come back tomorrow. So you can't immediately trade it. Or if you want to trade it now, you have to pay, you have to do it for a 2% lower price or something. It comes with like a bigger fee if you want to do it today. If you don't want to wait it, if you don't want to, or if you can wait, well, then you can get it at the normal price. But here's the big kicker. Because of the block space, and because of everything in the way Bitcoin has been designed and continues to be improved upon, fees will be rising in that block space because the people who do need to transact right now will be paying 2 times, 3 times, 4 times the fees likely. And everybody who does not need to trade immediately will just be like, all right, I'll just take a break. I'll go get some water, you know, come back in a couple of days and I'll just continue business as usual. And I'll have my saving, my gold coins right where they are. I don't need to save. I don't need to send them out right this second. My life is not being threatened. So, but what happens when you have 2 times, 3 times, 4 times the fees in the remaining blocks that come in at an hour and a half? The 10% of miners who have remained on the network suddenly have a massive surge in profitability because they're not only getting the block reward at the same time periods as they were before, because that those 10% of the miners were producing blocks on their own at about an hour and a half apiece, but the other 90% were just producing all the blocks in between. So those 10% of miners, the blocks didn't get harder for them to produce. They're making the exact same per block as they always were, but now they're getting a huge benefit in higher fees. So so while the miners who thought they were going to change the rules have gone off somewhere and now they have nowhere to send their coins, and not only have they not increased their profit, but they've lost any earnings whatever while having to fully maintain enormous operating costs. So the cheaters are bleeding. The cheaters are bleeding, and the miners who held strong, that small 10%, are literally having a party because their pay just doubled. And the only cost to the network is slow blocks, which anybody who's been here for any length of time and watched hundreds of cryptocurrencies go through this know, with so many real-world live network demonstrations, slow blocks have no meaningful effect on the long-term price of any coin. If that was the case, if it was all about block time or transaction speed, Litecoin would be 4 times the price of Bitcoin right now. Bcash would have died immediately with their 12-hour block times right after the fork. And Dogecoin would be the most valuable cryptocurrency in the world. Block times don't mean jack about the price of the coin. Claiming that a temporary span of 1.5-hour block times is going to kill Bitcoin is completely misunderstanding why Bitcoin is worth anything at all. So in the first situation, all Lite clients, the entire network is stuck using fake coins like good banking customers who've no choice when the banks unilaterally change the deposit and reserve requirements. Maybe they get mad, they cancel their account, they try to withdraw their money, they go hunting for an alternative bank or something. Somebody somewhere has to be honest. But it is all left up to the responsibility of the customer. They are the ones that have to go hunting for a change. They are the ones that have to go searching out for someone else to provide the right rules that they want, or they have to provide the business themselves. But in the latter scenario, it is none of the user's responsibility. Without knowing it, every single fully validating node will evict any bank that tries to cheat. In this case, we're talking about miners. Anyone who attempts to cheat the network is evicted by default. And the customer simply realizes that suddenly they're not using the same bank anymore. And they're like, well, that's interesting. But they are still following the same rules. They're just using only the 2 banks remaining that have chosen to continue following those rules. While the other banks are now paying for thousands of full-time employees and they have no customers because everyone was running a fully validating node. So that's kind of the relationship between the market and the business and the bank, if we're using the analogy that miners are banks in this scenario, in the fact that they're facilitating payments. So obviously, in the real network, that there is a mix of these two scenarios at play. There are lots of Lite clients. There are a lot of people depending on services and exchanges, and even some of those services may not even have run full nodes. But the vast majority of services and exchanges are running full nodes. There are thousands, tens of thousands of just normal users running full nodes, and they are a defense. They are a barrier, a fortress between anyone attempting to cheat the rules, minor or no, and any of those Lite clients connecting to that network. Those Lite clients and none of those nodes can see invalid data. They cannot and will not pass them on. The more full nodes on the network, the more the situation aligns with our second scenario, where the miners don't have any say and they can't spend their coins, and the more Lite clients and The higher the cost of running a full node and the fewer people who run it, the more the scenario looks like the SPV way, the idea where everyone is just hoping that the miners follow the rules. So, that's the dichotomy in our little thought experiment between the two separate networks. And we've got that mix today, but I got ahead of myself just a little bit because we're going to continue this tomorrow, and we're going to talk about the exact dynamics of why in a battle between a fully validating market and the miners will always lose out. I touched on a couple of the points today, but I want to go into it in more detail. And again, I haven't really found a specific article that hits this topic by itself. So I figure I'm just going to do another guy's take so we can continue with our theme of defining Bitcoin and what the role of fully validating nodes are on the network. And so basically, for now, we'll conclude this with the nature of nodes and the network, and that the only way to distinguish one coin from another in the digital realm is the set of rules that validate it. If you are not confirming the set of rules, it is meaningless that you are using a coin. You are just trusting that someone else tells you what kind of coin that is. And maybe that's a perfectly acceptable risk with what you're doing. Maybe all you need to do is have someone say, yeah, this is gold, don't worry about it. You can use it. And that's the only thing that you need to be to ensure that your $100 is safe, you know? Maybe it's a business you trust. You know Starbucks isn't going to tell you you're using gold and then sneak you some copper. But otherwise, you might as well be using copper. And that's why, that's where don't trust, verify comes from. Full nodes or nothing. The network is distinguished and defined by the validation rules. If you are not validating, you're just hoping someone else is being honest that you're using the Bitcoin network. Whew, man, this gets super heated in here. Okay, so I hope you guys enjoyed this. This is my breakdown of kind of a thought experiment on nodes on the network. And do not forget to follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. I've still been sitting on some edits left with the website. So check out cryptoeconomy.life. Again, this show is supported by donations largely, by and large. I mean, obviously, I do have some sponsors and through anchor.fm, and I'm so happy that I was able to use them to do that. So I'm making a little bit of money in right now, but it is definitely largely on donations. So the two things you can do to support this show, if you enjoy this content and you want to keep being able to listen to all the coolest stuff in Bitcoin, you can either donate on the website at cryptoeconomy.life. I've got a QR code in the sidebar, and I've also got a lightning tippin.me jar. If you want the Crypto Economy holiday calendar, I'm not sure if anybody listened to that. That's one of my recent Guys Take episodes where I just kind of go through a bunch of major events in the history of Bitcoin that I lived through. So if you want those on your digital calendar so that you don't miss them, you can get that for a lightning payment on my on the website as well, cryptoeconomy.life Bitcoin holidays. And then, oh yeah, obviously share it out to everybody you know. Tell people about this podcast. I am just finally going to be getting around to doing some real marketing with this thing. I've been very bad about all the business back end of this stuff. I just want to keep making content and just keep reading things. So every time it gets frustrating, I just resort back to reading Bitcoin articles and recording myself on audio. So I am trying to get better at that. But anything that you can do to share this out is a wonderful help. And thank you guys so much. I'm so excited. We're back in like a real heavy period of growth, and I'm loving it. So thank you. And don't miss tomorrow's episode on why in a fight between nodes and miners, the nodes will always win. All right. So thank you, and I will catch you tomorrow. with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. This is Guy Swan signing off. Until next time, take it easy, guys.